Argentina. It didn't take long to ID the men Phil Durkin had picked up in Argentina. They were a cross-section of thugs and hired killers the agency had used from time to time for assignments in South America. When they had identified his destination, Ryan called his ex to see if she might know why he had selected it. Had he ever mentioned any assignments or did he have any contacts all the way down there? Brenda Durkin had laughed. Phil had plenty of contacts in Patagonia, she said, and they were all slippery, but not in the way you think. Brenda explained that her husband was an avid fly fisherman and had taken multiple trips to Tierra del Fuego. His favorite place was the Cautepen Lodge on the banks of the Rio Grande River. The river flowed from the Andes down to the Atlantic and boasted the best sea trout fishing in the world. Before their marriage had turned sour, he had talked of retiring there. Though she could never prove it, she half suspected he had been building a house down there. That was all Harvath and the rest of the people gathered with General Johnson had needed to hear. They were convinced they knew where Phil Durkin was. At that point, it was only a matter of how to deal with him. Argentina was a politically sensitive country for the United States to deal with. They could be helpful in some areas, and downright obstructionist in others. It was decided that the less they knew about what was happening, the better. The weapons arrived in Tierra del Fuego via the Falklands and a contact the old man maintained in the British SAS. They offered shooters as well, but Carlton had politely declined. What he did take them up on, though, was surveillance. The SAS had an excellent stable of covert operatives on Tierra del Fuego, and they were happy to help out. By the time Harvath and his team arrived, Durkin's house had been located and everything was in place. Back in Northern Virginia, General Johnson and the old man were watching everything unfold via satellite. Lydia Ryan had insisted on coming along for the operation. From everything Harvath had heard about her, she was more than up to the task, and he had no objection. The old man wanted Sloane Ashby there, too, and Harvath was glad to have her. Her record spoke for itself. He had also roped in Matt Sanchez, who had performed so well in Somalia. General Johnson had recommended the team's final member. Chase Palmer of Odessa, Texas, had the distinction of being the youngest operator to ever have been admitted to the ranks of the U.S. Army's elite Delta Force unit. He was smart, battle-tested, and an exceptionally talented killer of the enemy. The Department of Defense had file cabinets stuffed full with accounts of his exploits. His teammates had nicknamed him AK for Ass Kicker. But the nickname took on a whole new meaning when he was caught with an empty AK-47 and was able to bluff six heavily armed Taliban into surrender. Some of his superiors resented not only his talent and meteoric rise, but also his above-average intelligence. When they called him AK, it stood for Asshole Kid. General Johnson, though, saw him for what he was, a tremendous asset to the United States, and had taken him under his wing. Though still technically a member of Combat Applications Group, or CAG, the name given to Delta Force to allow the Army to deny the existence of Delta Force, Palmer was assigned to General Johnson and served at his pleasure. Right now, the General's pleasure was to see to it that Operation Sierra, the codename given to the capture of Phil Durkin, was successful. "Targets have all been ranged. Command 6 is good to go," Sanchez replied over his microphone, as Harvath asked his team members one by one for their sit reps. The terrain was barren and windswept, more rock and loose shale than anything else. It was cold and misty. Everyone would rather have been someplace else, but you wouldn't have heard a complaint from a single one of them. This is who they were and what they did. Each of them consoled themselves with the knowledge that no matter how damp and how cold it was, it easily could have been worse, and that what they did for their country. They all knew that there were people who would never know their names and would never know what they were doing this night, but that their way of life hung in the balance. Lowering his night vision binoculars, Harvath looked at Ryan and said, "Are you ready for this?" She nodded. He pointed in the direction of the lodge and said, "We're on, then." Ryan didn't need the binoculars. She could see the pair of headlights as they drove out of the Cow to Pen and began bouncing along the rutted, partially washed-out road.
"This is Command One,"
Harbath said into his microphone, as he opened the door of his vehicle and stepped into the rain.
"Park Place. Repeat, Park Place."
Ryan exited as well, and opening her umbrella, stood near the back bumper of their 4x4 with a flashlight. While Harbath pretended to work on a tire, she watched the vehicle from the Cow to Pen Lodge as it wound its way up the ribbon of road, getting closer and closer. When it reached the right distance, Ryan began to flag the driver down with her flashlight. As the green Land Rover neared, it began to slow, coming to a stop behind their SUV. The driver was a handsome young man, dressed in Helly Hansen foul weather gear. Putting his Land Rover in park, he immediately stepped out to see if he could help.
"Can I help you?"
he asked in Spanish.
"I think we may have broken our axle," Ryan replied in English.
The polite young man switched into English as he approached.
"Would you like me to take a look?"
"You're from the Cow to Pen Lodge?"
she asked, pointing at the logo on the side of the man's vehicle. The young man nodded. The lodge participated in a hotel management program that brought in international hotelier students throughout the year, many from Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States. They were always polished and attractive, which added to the establishment's world-class feel.
"You probably have guests you need to get to the airport. We don't want to keep you."
"I'm by myself. I'm just delivering food. It's no problem for me to take a look. My cousin is a mechanic in town."
"I apologize," Ryan said.
Whether it was her statement or the gun she produced, it didn't matter. The effect was what was desired. The young man stopped and froze in place.
"Turn around,"
Ryan ordered.
"Hands on your head."
"You're rubbing me?" he asked, as he turned and did as she had instructed.
"Not exactly."
As Ryan kept him covered, Harbath rushed forward, cuffed his hands, and placed him in their vehicle. Waiting inside were Sloane Ashby and Chase Palmer. They listened carefully as Harbath asked the young man a quick series of questions regarding Phil Durkin's home and security measures. The young man was frightened and answered as best he could. Ryan tried to calm him down.
"Just answer our questions and everything will be okay. No one will hurt you."
The young man gave descriptions of everything he was asked until Harbath was satisfied that they had everything they needed.
"Let's roll," he said.
Nodding, Ashby and Palmer climbed out of the 4x4 and jogged back to the Land Rover. It was time to go to the next phase. As they got the Cow to Pen Lodge's Land Rover back on the road, Harbath alerted the rest of the team.
"Boardwalk,"
he said over the radio.
"All teams, boardwalk."
Chapter 70. As Ashby drove, Palmer sat in the back seat and organized the trays of hot food. If it had been him, he would have hired a local to do his cooking for him instead of having his dinners catered from the lodge. It didn't matter that Durkin could afford to do it. It just didn't seem tactically wise. Durkin, though, must have seen things differently. The hired help liked to talk. That was a potential liability he couldn't afford. Not when he was on the run and knew people would be looking for him. Having the food prepared and brought over, while expensive, did have several advantages, not the least of which was that access with the outside world was limited. As they closed in on Durkin's small ranch, Ashby gave a sit-rep over her radio and then asked for radio silence, as she didn't want any distractions at the gate. Pulling up to the wooden doors, she brought the vehicle to a stop and waited. Two burly men in ponchos stepped out of a stone guardhouse and motioned for the windows to be rolled down as they approached. Palmer had peeled back the lids on several of the trays so that the odor of food would permeate the Land Rover. Even standing outside the vehicle in the rain, the men smelled like coffee and cigarettes. The man on the driver's side asked where the other delivery boy was. Ashby answered that he had the Chilean flu and pantomimed drinking a large glass of booze. The man chuckled and asked her where she was from. He wanted to flirt a little bit with her. His buddy, on the other hand, wanted to eat.
"She's from the lodge via the kitchen," the other guard said. "Go see her when your shift is over. The food's getting cold."
Palmer laughed, though he shouldn't have. The line was not meant for him to hear. He was a servant and should have remained invisible. It was good-natured ribbing between two comrades. His interjecting himself had made it about the man's machismo.
"You think something is funny?" the first man asked.
"No, senor," he replied.
"Why are you laughing, then?"
Shit, Palmer thought to himself. This guy is bored and itching for a fight. He needed to come up with something quick.
"I laugh because she doesn't work in the kitchen. She works in the bar, and it's her fault our colleague has such a bad hangover."
The man on the passenger side laughed himself.
"See? There you go."
Palmer looked at the man on the driver's side. "There are two things you can never trust a woman with, alcohol and guns." The gruff man seemed to like this joke and smiled. Reaching his hand in the window, he touched Ashby a little too close to her breast and said,
"And what would a little girl like you do with a gun?"
Ashby pumped the gas as she took her foot off the clutch, which caused the Land Rover to leap forward a couple of feet. It also caused the overly friendly gate guard to snatch his hand back out of the window. The man on the other side of the vehicle found this quite amusing and laughed even louder.
"Okay," the first man growled as he caught back up to the Land Rover. "You can go in. Make sure you'll tell them to bring us our food," he added, pretending to put his hand back in. "I'll make sure to come see you later at the bar."
Ashby gunned the engine once more, and the man dramatically leapt back as if she were suddenly radioactive. His smiling colleague opened the gate and allowed them to enter. As they drove into the courtyard, she activated her radio and announced,
"Free parking."
Palmer smiled. Come to think of it, maybe this phase should have been called Community Chest. She flipped him the middle finger.
"We'll deal with your alcohol and guns comment later," she said.
And then, playing on his nickname, she added,
"Ass kisser."
He smiled as she brought the Land Rover to a stop outside the stone home's heavy wooden front doors.
"Just like we rehearsed it," she stated, as she turned off the ignition and they both hopped out.
Removing trays of food, they walked up the front steps. Ashby went first, followed by Palmer. Before she even reached the doors, they were opened for her. Two more men stood there. Ashby offered the trays to the taller of the two, but he shook his head.
"Kitchen,"
he told her. She started walking in the most likely direction, and the other man put his hand out to stop her. He peeled back the lid on the top tray each of them was carrying, while the taller man gave them a quick pat-down. When the taller man tried to give her a second pat-down, she sidestepped him and asked,
"Where's the kitchen?"
The man grunted out directions, and he and his colleague went back to their posts as she and Palmer walked down a wide hallway toward the rear of the house. The rest of Durkin's pals, four more men in total, were gathered around a large TV watching soccer and drinking beer. The man himself, though, was nowhere to be found.
"Excuse me, gentlemen," Palmer said. "Should we prepare 8 plates, or will there be others joining you?"
"Leave the food in the kitchen," one of the men said with a dismissive wave. "We'll get it ourselves."
A voice from Northern Virginia came over their earpieces. "We're picking up one additional heat signature in the northwest corner of the house."
"Understood," said Ashby.
Quickly, she and Palmer unpacked the food, along with their weapons, which had been sealed in Ziploc bags and hidden inside. With Palmer acting as a screen, she assembled a plate of appetizers and wrapped her suppressed weapon in a linen napkin underneath. She waited until the intensity of the soccer game began to pick up and then stepped into the television area.
"Who wants some?" she asked. "Compliments of Cow to Pen Lodge."
One of the men turned to tell her to shut up, but upon seeing her, his pockmarked face spread into a lascivious grin and he beckoned her over. His attention flitted back and forth between the soccer match and the attractive young lady carrying a plate of hot food. Something wasn't right, though. Was it the look in her eyes? Or was it the fact that he could only see one of her hands, and the other was hidden behind a napkin? Ashby knew she was in trouble when the man gave up any pretense of watching the match. As his grin faded and his eyes narrowed, she saw his hand go for his gun. It was on. "All teams go," she said over her radio, and taking aim, she let the rounds from her weapon fly. Chapter 71. As Harvath and Ryan came driving up the private road toward the gated ranch, Thing 1 and Thing 2 stepped out of the guardhouse. Matt Sanchez, hidden high above in the hills, watched it all unfold through the scope atop his rifle. "You're all clear," he said over his microphone. With Sanchez providing overwatch and Ryan in the passenger seat ready to engage any targets, Harvath leapt out of the 4x4 and opened the front gate. Driving into the courtyard in front of the house, they received an update that not only had Ashby taken out the four men near the kitchen, Palmer had neutralized the two men just inside the front door. The only man left was the only man they were looking for. Coasting to a stop, Harvath turned off their vehicle and removed the keys from the ignition. He and Ryan quietly climbed out and gently closed their doors. They met Palmer in the entry hall, and he signaled where he believed Durkin was holed up. Harvath nodded and gestured for him to circle around outside and make sure he didn't escape. Ashby would remain inside and make sure nobody snuck up on them from behind. With their weapons up and ready, they crept down the hallway toward Durkin and the northwest corner of the house. A door at the end of the hall was open, and a television could be heard from the inside. It was tuned to an American cable news channel. There was no other sound. Harvath didn't like it. How could Durkin have gone to all the trouble to set himself up at the end of the world with bodyguards and a gated retreat, but not have any intrusion detection measures? Did he feel that safe here? Or had he simply not gotten around to it because the ranch was never intended to be anything more than a fly fishing getaway? A few feet from the room, Harvath gave Ryan the signal to stop. He listened intently, his ears straining for any sound other than the TV coming from inside. He couldn't make anything out. Removing a flashbang from his coat pocket, he showed it to Ryan, counted to three, and pitched it into the room. He and Ryan crouched down, closed their eyes, plugged their ears, and opened their mouths to equalize the pressure from the blast. As soon as the device had detonated, they swept into the room. Durkin had been taken by surprise, but not by them. He lay on the floor of his study with a single gunshot wound to the back of his head, blood pooling around him. Ryan looked at Harvath.
"You've got to be kidding me."
Harvath reached down and touched his skin.
"This is fresh. He's still warm. Come on."
Running toward the front of the house, he radioed Ashby and Palmer to meet him there.
"How do you know the guy's not hopping on a ferry?" shouted Palmer as he rushed to the Land Rover.
"I don't," Harvath replied, as he jumped into the 4x4. "But we should assume he wants to get home as quickly as possible."
There were two airports on the island. Harvath hoped that he had selected the right one. Just in case, he sent Sanchez toward the other. Better to only have one person there than none at all. As he raced toward his airport, Harvath asked General Johnson's team to zoom their satellite out to try to help him find what he was looking for.
"There are vehicles coming and going in both directions," a voice from Northern Virginia said over their earpieces. "We need more to narrow down the search."
"We don't have more," Harvath replied. "The target could be in a car, a truck, or even on a motorcycle."
"Searching," said the voice. "Stand by."
Ryan looked at Harvath as he pulled the wheel hard to the left and then swung out onto the main road.
"If the house was under satellite surveillance, how the hell did anyone get in or out without being seen?" she asked.
"With the weather, they were relying heavily on thermal imagery. That kind of technology is no longer foolproof. In fact, if you have the right resources, anything can be beaten."
The analyst's voice from Northern Virginia came back over their earpieces. "We've now got a plane warming up at Ushuaia International."
"Get somebody to overlay a schematic for an Ariane SBJ," said Harvath. I want to know if you get a match.
The Fed helped Durkin escape, only to turn around and kill him? Ryan asked.
I think somebody doesn't want him to talk.
Who?
Harbath was about to reply when the voice from Northern Virginia came back. We've got a hit on that aircraft profile, it said. You were right. Arion SBJ. We also picked up a cell phone transmission between what we believe is the aircraft and a vehicle about 15 miles ahead of you.
Harvath looked at Ryan as he stepped on the accelerator and said,
I think we're about to get all of our questions answered.
By the time they caught up with the blue Chevrolet Celta, they were less than 10 miles outside Ushuaia. Harvath slowed his approach so as not to spook the driver.
What do you want to do?
Ryan asked.
We're going to box him in, he replied,
as he radioed Ashby and Palmer to tell them what he wanted to do.
Roger that, Ashby acknowledged. Punching the accelerator, she first passed Harbath's vehicle and then the Chevy Celta, before settling into the lead position on the road to Ushuaia. Palmer had wanted to see if he could get a look at the driver, but Harvath had warned him not to. He wanted to take him by surprise. It was bad enough that the Land Rover had the fishing lodge's logo emblazoned on the side of it. He didn't need a man who was no stranger to killing, locking eyes potentially with another such man. He told Palmer to pretend like he was asleep. If the driver of the Celta suspected anything, he gave no indication, as he maintained his present course and speed. Getting back on his radio, Harvath told Northern Virginia there was one other thing he was going to need, and that the old man better get back on the phone to his SAS contact, quick. 5 minutes later, the old man came back to him with a safe house location. Immediately after, Ashby told Harvath she could see a stoplight ahead, and that they should launch the ambush at the next red. As Ryan plugged the location into her GPS device, Harvath saw the Land Rover up ahead, and just beyond that, the stoplight.
Put your head against the headrest, he told her.
Ryan did it, and flashed him the thumbs up. Harvath calculated their speed. It wouldn't take much to surprise the driver of the Celta, but he didn't want to surprise him. He wanted to stun him if possible. He also wanted to make sure that he wasn't going so fast that his airbags deployed. As the Land Rover slowed down for the next light, the Celta slowed as well, but Harvath maintained his speed. When he struck the tiny car, he sent it skidding sideways across the wet pavement into a lamppost. Before he could even release his seatbelt and glance at Ryan to make sure she was okay, Ashby and Palmer were already out of the Land Rover with their weapons drawn. They immediately closed the distance with the Celta, threw open the door, and pulled its bloody driver into the street. As Harvath jumped out of his 4x4, he recognized the man immediately. He didn't know who he had been expecting, but William Jacobson, the Federal Reserve security chief, definitely wasn't it. Chapter 72. William Jacobson was a hard, stubborn son of a bitch. Trying to get information out of him had been like trying to get blood from a stone. The old man had pulled his jacket, and there weren't any significant pressure points they could find. He had no wife, no children, no family. He was incredibly loyal to his employer. No matter how badly Harvath threatened him, he wouldn't part with even the smallest detail about what the Fed, and with it Monroe Lewis, had been up to. If Harvath had to torture him, he would, but that was never the first card he played. He was starting to think, though, that it was quickly working its way up to the top of the deck. Harvath had already played what he thought was one of his strongest cards. He had threatened to turn Jacobson over to the Argentines to face murder charges, and the man hadn't even flinched. No matter what downside Harvath outlined for the man, Jacobson simply shrugged it off, or fixed Harvath with a cold, vindictive stare. It was as if the man believed there was no force that the Fed couldn't overcome and rescue him from. This left Harvath with very few options.
I have to tell you, Will, he said, things are about to get even worse for you. You either start cooperating, or you'll only have yourself to blame for what happens. We're a very long way from home, and nobody is coming to save you.
Jacobson laughed. You have no idea what you're tangled up in, do you?
I have a pretty good idea. One of Durkin's guys, a man named Stark, had a lot to say before Sal Sabatini killed him.
Durkin's guys are pros. They'd never talk.
Everyone talks, Will, Harbath replied with a smile. It's just a matter of when. For Stark, it was when one of Durkin's swim club psychos pulled up in front of his house and gave him a play-by-play over the phone of what his family was up to.
The smile faded from Jacobson's face. Harbath pressed his advantage.
The killer is named Samuel. Ever heard of him?
A barely perceptible tick registered on the security chief's face. Most would have missed it. Harbath didn't.
If you haven't met Samuel, you should. I think he'd like you. Or maybe not. I suppose it all depends with an unstable personality like that. But I assume you know that. Salvatore Sabatini is another whack job. You'd love him, too.
Sabatini is dead, Jacobson said. You shot him.
I shot him, but I didn't kill him. I merely clipped his wings. Everyone thinks he's dead, but that was so we could keep him safe. We have him in a very special cage, in a very secret place.
Both of them are nuts.
I agree, said Harbath. Completely nuts. What's amazing is that their stories are almost believable. You know who they sound a lot like?
He asked, studying his face.
Besides Stark, of course.
Right then, there was another micro-expression that flashed across Jacobson's face. Harbath was definitely hitting close to home.
The other person they sound like, Harbath continued, is Tara.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
The man answered a little too quickly, a little too emphatically.
Funny, because I have surveillance footage of you entering and leaving her apartment building 2 days ago. Didn't find much, did you?
The vindictive stare was back again.
You can give me the tough guy stare all day long, said Harbath, or we can talk, man to man.
Jacobson guffawed. I told you. You have no idea what you're dealing with.
Why don't you break it down for me?
The security chief was dead silent. Harbath smiled.
Will, trust me when I tell you, we're now quickly approaching my least favorite alternatives. Like I said, I don't want to hurt you, but it is on my list. Sooner or later, everyone talks.
The man chuckled again. Harbath nodded to Palmer, who produced a pair of EMT shears and cut away Jacobson's clothing. Ashby came in with a metal pail filled with water and a stack of towels.
Are you going to waterboard me?
Harbath tilted his head.
Anything's possible. It all depends on you.
Palmer tore off two strips of duct tape from a roll and pressed one down onto Jacobson's gray chest hair, and the other on his equally hairy left side beneath his armpit. He then grabbed a corner of each and ripped them off. The security chief cried out as much in surprise as in pain. As Ashby placed adhesive pads on the now hairless patch of skin, Harbath shared with him something he had learned from his file.
You've been on both Crestor and Lipitor. Now you're on something I can't even pronounce. There are some other heart-related meds in your file, which tells me...
How the fuck did you get a hold of my medical records?
It's a brave new world, my friend. You think Durkin's people are the only ones who can hack into electronic medical records?
Jacobson glared at him.
So, Harbath continued, based on your meds, I'm guessing you either have a bad ticker, or there's a serious history of heart disease in your family. Either way, we're going to do a little stress test together.
No sooner had Harbath said the words than he noticed the tick race across the man's face again. Wires led from the adhesive pads to a small black storm case whose lid was up and facing Jacobson. He couldn't see what was inside, but his instincts told him it was some sort of defibrillator on steroids, meant to deliver increasingly unhealthy shocks to his heart. When the young female removed his shoes and socks and placed his feet into the pail of water,
he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that his instincts were right on the money.
"This part can get really uncomfortable,"
Harbath said.
"You may find your mind going in a bunch of different directions, so let me help you out. Here's what I know. I know that Phil Durkin ran a host of black ops programs out of the Central Intelligence Agency. One of those programs was a political destabilization team. Yes or no?"
"Fuck you," said Jacobson.
"Wrong answer,"
Harbath replied, as he nodded to Palmer. Palmer made ready behind the open lid of the storm case, as if he were about to throw some sort of switch. But as he did, Jacobson broke.
"Wait!"
"Yes or no?"
Harbath commanded.
"Wait!"
Harbath looked at Palmer and said,
"He's stalling. Shock him. Hard."
"Yes,"
Jacobson said quickly.
"Durkin handled the team and Tom Cushing ran it."
Now they were getting somewhere. It was time to see if what Stark had told Bill Wise in Boston was true.
"Was Cushing's team involved with the Arab Spring?"
The security chief nodded.
"Cushing's team was the Arab Spring. They organized all of it, right down to that fruit vendor who kicked it all off in Tunisia."
"How about Jordan?"
Ryan interjected.
"Is Jordan on the list?"
It was the first time she had spoken during the interrogation, and both Jacobson and Harbath looked at her.
"Tell me,"
she ordered.
"I have no idea," Jacobson replied. "All those countries are the same as far as I'm concerned. I couldn't tell one from another on a map, and I don't give a rat's ass."
"Was the prior Federal Reserve Chairman, Sawyer, funding Durkin's black ops programs before he died?"
asked Harbath.
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because he needed that destabilization team."
"Why?"
Harbath repeated. Jacobson fell silent once more. Harbath looked at Palmer.
"Turn it all the way up and juice him. I don't care if his heart does explode. I'm tired of being jerked around."
"No!"
Jacobson shouted.
"I'll tell you."
"You've got 30 seconds.
The Saudis."
"What about them?"
Harbath demanded.
"The Saudis were blackmailing Chairman Sawyer."
"Blackmailing him? How?"
"The dollar has become worthless. The Fed has created too many of them, and the U.S. government has run up hundreds of trillions of dollars in debt."
"Hold on," Harbath admonished. "The U.S. debt is nowhere near that number."
Jacobson shook his head and laughed.
"You have no idea how bad things are. It's a house of cards, and it is all ready to come down. The Saudis figured it out. Without our protection, they're going to be overrun. They wanted to create a buffer zone."
"Why would Sawyer care about what Saudi Arabia wants?"
"Because the only thing preventing our house of cards from falling is the fact that oil is bought and sold in dollars, American dollars. Take that away, and everything goes bye-bye. The dollar collapses, the economy collapses, and civilization follows."
Harbath was stunned.
"And that's what the Saudis threatened to do? Collapse the dollar?"
Jacobson nodded.
"Normally, their intelligence services can't even rub two sticks together. But this time, they came up with one hell of an idea. Think about it. When the United States collapses, Saudi Arabia is going to be at the mercy of its neighbors. Why not work to make sure all of your neighbors are sympathetic to your cause? Let me ask you, in all of the Arab Spring countries that have been overthrown so far, who has risen up to be the new government?"
"The Muslim Brotherhood," said Harbath.
"Which is loyal to which kinds of Muslims? The Shia Iranians or the Sunni Saudis?"
"The Sunni Saudis, of course. Iran is Saudi Arabia's greatest enemy."
"The Saudis aren't stupid. In fact, they're quite cunning. They didn't bother taking their ultimatum to America's politicians, who are subject to re-election and the whims of the masses. They went over their heads and straight to the ultimate defender of the dollar, the Federal Reserve." "What people don't grasp," Jacobson continued, "is that empires collapse. Ours will too if we don't do everything we can to keep it alive."
"And whose idea was it to go after the Fed candidates?"
Harbath asked.
"Durkin's."
"Why?"
"Chairman Sawyer wasn't just funding Durkin's team for the Arab Spring. He was funding a ton of other projects as well. It was a quid pro quo. Durkin made the Arab Spring happen, and in return, Sawyer secretly opened the money spigot for him. There was just one problem. He was growing increasingly uncomfortable with how Durkin was doing things. The chairman's tenure was coming to an end, and he was the one who had pushed the Board of Governors and convinced them that the next chairperson should come from outside the Fed. The five candidates were all people he thought could successfully firewall the dollar off from any further Saudi threats, and just as important, would resist Durkin.
But Durkin found out about the candidates and had them killed, said Harvath.
Jacobson nodded.
And then what? He keeps killing candidates until he gets one he likes?
You're not thinking like Durkin.
Elucidate me, Harvath replied.
He never set foot on the road to toppling any Muslim government without knowing exactly who he wanted to install at the top.
We didn't get hired to prevent these murders, did we? Harvath said.
No. The Federal Reserve needed to be seen to be doing everything they could. Plus, we wanted to have an extra set of eyes and ears as close to the investigation as possible.
Who's we? You and Monroe Lewis?
There was a look on Jacobson's face that sent all of the tumblers in Harvath's mind locking into place.
That's who Durkin wanted as the new chairman, isn't it?
Jacobson simply smiled.
How are you going to do it?
The Federal Reserve has a lot of secrets. There's one in particular that would be particularly damaging if it was brought to light.
You were going to blackmail the Board of Governors into recommending Lewis for the chairmanship? Harvath asked.
The governors are unaware of this particular skeleton in the Fed's closet. Lewis was going to not only bring it to their attention, but offer a rather clever solution to the problem.
Which would result in his name being put forward for the chairmanship.
Jacobson smiled again.
And you came down here to kill Durkin, to tie up loose ends.
Jacobson's smile continued. Harvath studied the man's face.
What's in this for you? He asked. Why did you go along with it all?
The world economy is crumbling. Something very bad, very dark is on the horizon. The chaos and anarchy the United States will face is like nothing history has ever seen. It's going to be beyond biblical, he said, pausing for a moment before adding, the storm's coming, and there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. I just want a seat on the ark.
And you didn't care what you had to do to get it.
Jacobson smiled once more, and Harvath had heard enough. He had trekked far beyond his purview. Stepping outside the safe house, he activated his satellite phone so that he and the old man could talk about it in private. This wasn't something he could make the call on. The president himself would have to decide what to do next. Chapter 73. Washington, District of Columbia. You can call it whatever you like, George, said the president to his director of national intelligence, but I call it treason. We're a nation of laws. That's what makes us a republic. We need to start enforcing those laws and making examples of those who think they're above them. And the financial system? The Secretary of the Treasury asked. We need to allow it to fail. That damn Federal Reserve has done nothing but allow banks to take bigger and bigger risks, and whenever they get in over their heads, it's the taxpayers and their hard-earned money that is used over and over again to bail them out. That needs to stop.
So we remove all restrictions from the financial industry?
Hell no, the president said, rebuking him. I want a top-to-bottom review in the next 72 hours. I want to streamline that entire industry. They'll succeed, or they'll fail on their own. That they'll know where the lines are drawn, and that they'll be enforced. No longer will we hold that any business is too big to fail, and I don't want to hear that any person is too big to jail. It is going to be painful, I'll give you that. But we need to take our medicine now, right now. If we don't, we'll never pull out of the nosedive we're in. Our creditors need to know that not only do we have our house in order, we are also going to begin paying off our debt. For every job that's been shipped overseas, we're going to see five more spring up here by this government creating the most pro-business climate in the history of the modern world.
And what about the Federal Reserve? The Secretary of the Treasury asked.
We're not renewing their charter.
We're not? The man replied, stunned.
No, the power to print money was intended for the Congress, not to be outsourced to some banking monopoly masquerading as a government agency. You've got 24 hours to get back to me with a plan on how we disentangle ourselves from the Fed.
But, Mr. President, the man began.
No buts. We've shut down central banks before in this country. It's past time we do it again.
The shock to the economy could
be just what this country needs, replied the president.
They went over a couple of additional items before the president thanked the Treasury Secretary for coming and excused him from the balance of the meeting. Harvath, Ryan, Wise, McGee, and Reed Carlton were all then shown into the Oval Office. It was the first time any of them had met the president. He directed them to the couches in the center of the room and asked them to sit down.
We saw the Secretary of the Treasury on his way out, said Carlton. He didn't look so well.
Good, replied the president. Have you seen the state of our economy? The man should go to bed every night worrying that tomorrow he'll be swinging from a lamppost if things don't get better. I know I do.
The president had been elected largely based on his common sense and a no-BS approach to problems. He was very charismatic, and unlike many of the slippery politicians in Washington, seemed to not only genuinely care about the condition that the country was in, but also to be truly confident that things could be turned around, and that collapse wasn't inevitable.
But you're not here to talk about what keeps me up at night, said the president. First, I want to thank you for what you did. I understand there were a few others who helped you, he said as he peered down at his notes, a Ms. Sloan Ashby and Messrs. Chase Palmer and Matthew Sanchez. Please also extend my thanks to them. Carlton assured the president that it would be done.
Excellent, he replied. Now, on to business. Looking first at Ryan, then Wise, and finally McGee, he said,
I don't know what the hell is going on at CIA, but it's going to stop now. It needs all of the deadwood cleared out and a brand new culture instilled. It's filled with patriotic men and women who would go to the ends of the earth for this country if the bureaucrats gumming up the system would just get out of their way and let them do it. This whole Phil Durkin situation never should have happened. I have already asked the DCI for his resignation.
Ryan and McGee were shocked.
Who's going to replace him? McGee asked.
You are, said the president. Both of you.
Co-directors? Replied Ryan.
Unless you think one person can handle turning that agency around in the next 12 months.
The old man smiled.
I take it you approve, said the president.
Yes, sir, replied Carlton. In fact, if I may say so, it should have been done a long time ago.
It's being done now.
Turning to Wise, the president asked, Do you have any desire to come out of retirement and serve your country again?
If my country needs me, I'm happy to come out of retirement.
I think Ryan and McGee are going to have their hands full. They're going to need someone they can trust to help weigh who stays, who goes, what gets saved, what gets cut, etc.
I can't promise you it will be glamorous, but I can promise you that you'll have the appreciation of a grateful nation.
Wise nodded.
Thank you, sir. It would be my honor.
Good. I have already spoken with His Majesty in Jordan. He, of course, feigned outrage that his intelligence service was blackmailing the CIA with an active terrorist plot in order to extract information about Durkin's political destabilization team. He assured me that the bombers would be apprehended immediately, and that any and all information they have on the plot will be shared with us straight away. Ryan, I'd like you to review it and brief General Johnson, who will in turn brief me.
Yes, sir, Ryan replied.
What else? The president asked as he flipped through his notes.
I've asked the Attorney General to give me recommendations as to how Sal Sabatini and this Samuel character ought to be handled. I have to tell you that I'm less worried at this point about the legal process than I am at the prospect that there could be others like them running around out there. Dr. Wise, I'd like you to make Swim Club, as well as all the other black programs Durkin had kept alive, your immediate focus at the agency.
Yes, sir, said Wise.
Speaking of Durkin's black programs, I understand the last member of the destabilization team, a Tara Fleming, has been placed in FBI custody and is being debriefed. I expect to meet with the FBI director soon to discuss what, if anything, he believes should be done with her. Which brings me finally to Mr. Monroe Lewis of the Federal Reserve. The scandals be damned. He's going to stand trial for what he did. His security chief is going to be charged as an accessory as well. I think that does it, he said, glancing once more at his notes. Am I missing anything? Carlton raised an eyebrow. I'll get to your request in a moment, the president replied. Focusing on the others, he said, I want to thank you again for what you did. It took tremendous courage. It's that kind of bravery and sacrifice that is going to bring this nation back to prominence. Remember that when things get tough up on the 7th floor at Langley, because they will get tough. We will, sir, said McGee, as he stood and shook the president's hand. Thank you, sir. Ryan and Wise joined him, and after they both shook the president's hand and said goodbye, they exited the Oval Office along with Bob McGee. Harvath and the old man sat facing the Director of National Intelligence and the President. The President looked at Carlton and said, General Johnson debriefed me on what happened in Somalia and shared your request to pin the firefight and the casualties on Durkin. I'm going to grant the request. Run everything through the General's office, and as long as it all has his approval, I'm okay with it. Technically, though, this conversation never happened. Understood? Understood, the old man replied, pleased that he'd be able to put the Siena Star issue to bed and get their agency paid. I also understand that your firm lost its DOD contract, and since that time has been struggling a bit. I wouldn't say we've been...
That's correct, sir, Harbath replied,
cutting off his boss and answering the president's question. I also understand, Mr. Harbath, that you worked for a prior president and helped chalk up some big wins. How come the next administration didn't hold you over?
They had a different worldview, sir.
The president thought about that for a moment. I am very bullish on America's future. I make no secret about that. But before we return to prosperity and abundance, I believe we are going to face profound darkness and be tested like never before in this nation's history. When that happens, the United States is going to need its very best and very brightest to push back the darkness and take the fight to any enemy that would see us destroyed, both foreign and domestic. I'd like to be able to count on your organization. I want you to be a part of that fight. With some of the reorganization that General Johnson and I are planning for the intelligence community, we believe a place can be made for you. Would that be of interest? Simultaneously, Harvath and Carlton replied,
Yes, sir.
I'm glad to hear that, said the president, as he rose, signaling that the meeting was over. As he walked them slowly to the door, he left them with one final thought. A man who occupied this office years ago once said that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same. Or one day, we will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in the United States when men were free. He then shook their hands and said, I'm glad to know that you'll both be with me in this fight. Epilogue. Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
I promise you, said Harvath, I'm not going to let anything happen to him. Trust me. Says the guy who lied to me about not being able to swim.
Harvath smiled and pulled her close. Her skin felt warm and smooth against him, her body perfectly fitting with his. He kissed her neck, just below her ear, and then gave her a playful bite. She squealed and tried to get away, but couldn't. He was holding on just tight enough to make it impossible. They had been at the beach for a week, and Harvath couldn't remember ever being this happy. It had been a long time for Lara Cordero as well. Harvath and Marco had been inseparable. They had walked the beach together, picking up buckets full of rocks and shells, along with piles of sticks and huge pieces of driftwood. The little boy laughed when Harvath would pretend the pieces were too heavy and struggled to pick them up. They built sandcastles with enormous moats, went for ice cream at least once a day, and rode bikes everywhere. It was a perfect vacation, and Harvath and Lara had both needed it. But the question bubbling to the surface was if they needed more than just a vacation. As far as he was concerned, Lara was not only gorgeous, tough as hell, and accomplished in her own right, but she was also very smart. Though he'd been dead set against her plan for taking down Sal Sabatini, she'd been right, and he had been wrong, a fact she found no end of joy in reminding him of. Lara hadn't wanted a shootout in her apartment that could have killed her son or her parents. In fact, she had rightly put their safety above everything else. Neither of them had known for sure if Sabatini would still be in her apartment when they got there, but her instincts had told her he would be. She had given Harvath the key for the apartment's back door and had made him promise that if he could get to Marco and get him out safely, he would do it. Harvath had honored that promise, waking up the first floor tenants, giving them the boy, and telling them not to open the door for Sal as he returned upstairs to help Lara. To her credit, she had instructed her parents to run as soon as Sal let her out of the living room and down the hall to Marco's room. He had come completely unglued by that point, and she was seriously worried that he might kill her. The only thing that gave her any comfort was knowing that Harvath had saved her son, and even if he couldn't get back in time to save her, at least her little boy would survive. But Harvath had come back, and he had in fact saved her. He had also honored the other half of the promise she had sworn him to, which was that he wouldn't kill Sal unless he had no other choice. When asked why he hadn't simply taken the man by surprise and knocked him out with the butt of his weapon, Harvath replied, "You said I couldn't kill him. You didn't say I couldn't shoot him." His sense of humor was just one of the many things about him that she had grown increasingly attracted to. The second night on Cape Cod, after they had put Marco to bed, they opened a bottle of wine and talked. Or more to the point, she had asked questions, and Harvath had talked. She wanted to know everything about him, and he had told her, more than he had ever told any woman before. Harvath wasn't a soft man, but he also wasn't so hard that he couldn't make room for someone like Lara Cordero and her son in his life. He was scared to admit it, but he'd fallen in love with that little guy the moment he saw him, and he was quickly realizing that the same might be true for Lara as well. He didn't know where any of this was going. All he knew was that he wanted the two of them to be in his life going forward. As long as he could lug huge pieces of driftwood up and down the beach, he knew he could count on Marco being on board. Lara, though, was another question. She had been slow to open up about her past, and he hadn't pushed her. He didn't really care what was behind them. He cared only about what might be in front of them, and today was a watershed moment. Harvath hadn't wanted to come to this stretch of beach. It had been Lara's idea.
"I need to finally say goodbye," she had told him, and he had been okay with that.
Closure was important, especially when someone so important in your life had died. They had spent the afternoon doing all the things Marco liked doing on the beach, but they hadn't been in the water. Coming back to Cape Cod was a big enough deal as it was. Going into the water where she had lost her husband might be a bridge too far. Harvath smiled at her again and, scooping up Marco in his arms, leapt to his feet.
"I promise," he repeated, "it'll be okay."
Lara looked at him and slowly smiled back. In that moment, he thought, or maybe hoped, that he was seeing something fall away, much like the armor of her police persona, which dropped piece by piece on her way home at the end of the day. Standing up from their blanket, she wrapped her arms around them both and kissed them.
"I know it'll be okay," she said. "Why don't we all go in together?"
Hidden Order was written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz. The recording engineer was Ethan Donaldson. Editing and post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Joanna Solitaro. Hidden Order was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Hidden Order by Brad Thor is available in hardcover from Emily Bessler Books and Atria. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio by Brad Thor, Full Black, read by Armin Schultz, and The Athena Project, read by Elizabeth Marvel.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.